Patrick, it is a real pleasure to be able to speak to you about your memoir, Making It So. There's a bit of a trend at the moment for people to write memoirs when they're barely out of their 20s, but you have put your whole life into this book.
I'm out of my 20s.
That, that is true. Was there anything that sort of particularly precipitated you wanting to sit down and write this memoir?
COVID.
Right.
I'd been offered by publishers, including once before by Simon and Schuster, to write a memoir or an autobiography. I didn't know much about the word memoir
Yeah.
in those days. And I'd never been able to accept, not because I didn't want to do it, I was curious, but because I couldn't. The work I was doing, I mean, shooting a television series is a little time consuming. No time to write a book.
Yeah.
My agent called me from Hollywood and said, "Look, Patrick, nobody's going to work because there is no work, nothing. And it could go on like this for months and months. Now is your chance to write the memoir. You've got nothing else to do." And he said, "And if he said, if you don't like it, if it doesn't work out, that's fine. We'll return their advance." "Oh, will we?" I thought. "And you can," yeah, she said this, "go back to playing your jigsaw puzzles," which I do. It's a hobby.
And this is obviously, this has taken you so far away from the very humble beginnings, which is where you start the book, your childhood in Murfield. It's an extraordinary read because you share very honestly how difficult life was, the real poverty that your family was dealing with. But you seem to be quite a happy child, as you say, up until about the age of five. And then there's this shift in the family, isn't there, when your father was demobbed and not happy, basically, by the change in his life. And you're quite honest about sort of how that changed things.
Yes, I didn't have to write about any of that, but there is this discomfort occasionally about writing a memoir where if you might have something that's not exactly enthusiastic about a job or a director or an actor, I didn't want to get into that area.
Yeah.
It's all too delicate. Other actors I've seen are fearless. They wipe and smash at people, you know, they haven't liked working with. But I didn't. With my family, I felt that if I was hoping to explain myself, which after all is what a memoir I think is meant to do, so that there is a deeper understanding of who that is, things like the impact of something on my child life, especially between the ages of 1 and 10, can have a strong and lasting impact, as mine has had. And in my case, it was blissful happiness from the moment of my birth to the moment that my father came home from the Second World War in about September of 1945, when I was just five. My father had been in the army. When he got my mother pregnant in the 20s, the moment he learned that she was pregnant, he joined the army.
Right.
Apparently not an uncommon thing for men to do. And he disappeared to India for years and years. And then he came home, and his life in the military was over, and there was nothing much to do where we were living but coal mining, weaving sheds, big, that kind of industry. And we lived not far from Sheffield, which was the center of the steel industry and so forth. It didn't have a good effect on him. And when the Second World War started, he signed up again. He joined the military. I think he saw it as a chance to be free again.
Yeah.
And I've done some calculations on a 1939, 1940 timetable, and I think it's very, very probable I was conceived the night before my father went to war in the Second World War in Europe.
Right.
Can't guarantee it, and there's nobody left alive to ask.
Right.
And anyway, it would have been, I think, a very insensitive thing to ask. But I was born And I lived with my mother and my 5-year older brother, Trevor. Mm. And we had a wonderful life. We had almost nothing. My mother was a weaver. She had been for years and years, and she would be for decades to come. Mm. And I once went, visited her at the mill. She was a very shy, rather quiet, very sweet-natured, very loving woman. There are photographs of her in here, two of them. And a delightful manner. It was a blissful first few years of my life. I had a cot in her bedroom, and we only had one room up and one room down. Mm. And there was a corner that was kind of paneled off where my brother and I shared a double bed. Mm. For 6 years, we shared this double bed. There's a photograph.
There's a lovely picture of the two of you actually in bed, isn't there? I suppose that sort of, as you say, that domestic setup that you had was very much changed when your father returned from the Second World War.
Well,
and
yes.
You describe him as being a sort of a weekend alcoholic, so he would work in the week and then...
Yes. He came home in like September of 1945, when I was just 5 years old.
Yeah.
And our lives changed totally. First of all, he was in the house. Mm. And with only one room downstairs and one room upstairs, there wasn't a lot of privacy.
Yeah.
And there was no toilet, no bathroom, no running hot water. The toilet was outside, and that became my reading room. Mm. Because we had no televisions. I didn't have a television set until I was 15. We had no gramophone to play. All we had was the radio. And my father listened entirely to BBC Four. Mm-hmm. He got a job, again, labouring, and he was very frustrated. And he began drinking at weekends. Mm. He became technically what is known as a weekend alcoholic. Mm. Monday through Friday evening, he was totally dry, clean. But then on Friday evening, he would begin to drink, which led to two things possible. My father, when he returned from the pub or the club, would be singing.
Yeah.
And we could hear him on the street because there was no traffic around, no airplanes or anything like that. And if it was a popular song of the time, everything was okay. If it was a military song, there was potential trouble brewing because he would spark up and get angry.
Yeah.
It was described to me by an expert when I did a show called Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah.
Well, I met a military medical person who talked to me about my father and about his experience in 1939 when he was part of the Allied excursion force that attacked the Nazis, the Germans in Europe.
Mm.
He did very well then. He got promoted.
You sort of say in the book that it was that status that he had achieved in the army.
Yes.
When it was stripped away from him on return to home, that was the thing that left him angry, wasn't it?
That's right. And disturbed. And it was explained to me, your father had PTSD.
Right.
There's no question of that. We know what conditions were like where he was retreating. Most people were heading for Dover. My father actually made it to Cherbourg, where he got on the last boat out. It was such a shocking demonstration of violence. Mm. Civilians, queues of civilians on the run as well, which we have seen something more of. And recently, massacres.
Yep.
In fact, I was stood on one point of road and they said, we know your father would have stood here. Mm. A sergeant. And he was trying to get these people back to the coast, back home to England, if possible, because there were planes and bombers and everything going overhead.
Mm.
And he made it. He was, when his last ship left Cherbourg, the Nazis were already in the suburbs of Cherbourg.
Mm.
So he just made it out.
Yeah.
So he didn't go to prisoner of war camp. When he came back, and he was once again in basically a labouring life.
Yeah.
And he'd been a superstar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone who had served with him after he died. I ran into him in a pub one day, a little local pub near where we live. And he introduced himself and said, I I soldiered with your father. We were in the same regiment. He said, let me tell you something about him. And he did a number of things. He said, but here's the most important thing about your father. When he walked onto the parade ground, the birds in the trees stopped singing. It was a wonderful thing to say about authority, presence, you know.
No more
whistling as well.
Your respect for him is really clear in the book, but I think as well there's another thing, which is that your empathy, so in understanding why he might have struggled and then become sort of violent, you know, at home with your mother, I think that sort of nods towards where you would end up going in your own life, because actors have to have great empathy skills in order to understand people and how they work. You also say in the book that, of course, that unsettled domestic setting is, of course, perfect breeding ground for somebody to want to find safety with another family, and that often exists in something like theatre. The passages where you talk about these inspirational teachers who helped you to get into a career from acting, because, of course, looking at your childhood in a small village in Yorkshire, it would be difficult to understand how you could end up going from there to, you know, movie screens across the world. But part of that is your huge hard work. Your ethic is incredible in this book.
My father.
So that's where that comes
from
as well?
That's his influence, yes.
Because you had to work, you did a couple of jobs before you ended up going to drama school, because you worked as a furniture salesman and a journalist.
I was both for a year each.
You did manage to get some fantastic support from where you were, from one teacher at school, and then a fantastic woman, Ruth Winone, who taught you acting. Sort of privately, and they both helped you to get into Bristol Old Vic Drama School. Your tales of sort of training will be familiar to anybody like me who's been to drama school. It seems that some things never change. But there's an amazing bit at the end when you're graduating and the principal brings you into his office, and he utters this sentence with a very crucial pause in the middle, which breaks your heart, because he said to you, Patrick, you will never achieve success. Pause. By insuring against failure, which I think is one of the most amazing pieces of acting advice. Is that something that you have sort of carried forward?
I carried it at once, but not in the depth and detailed way that I did in later years.
Yeah.
And I still think about that remark. Failure. Why would you even consider failure as an object? That would be criminal. And sabotaging. So that was the most important thing. The first big influence on my life was my English teacher. Mm. At the age of 12, he became also my form master, and was for the next 3 years until I left school at 15. And he was the person who first cast me in a play with adults. Where I grew up in the West Riding of Yorkshire, amateur acting was incredibly popular. So you weren't weird if you did it. You won't be saying, ooh, you're doing acting. Ooh, that's weird, you know. No, not at all. It was absolutely popular. And there was one in my school. The staff of my school had an acting group, which was not part of the education that they were giving, but they did it in the evenings. And Cecil Dormand was one of them. And he also directed. Mm. And one day he said, I got a part for you in our next play. 12-year-old boy, same just like you. Okay, right? And I said, yeah, all right. I've never been in a play. He said, yeah, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. And so he directed me in my first stage role. And over the next 3 years, talked to me and gave me advice. He gave me a complete works of Shakespeare, which we didn't have in my house, not at all. Mm. And then my teacher, Ruth Winone, who was my acting teacher, which Cess Dormand had not really been, and she said to me, look, Patrick, I think you should go to drama school. I think that's the best way for you to make a start if you want to. And I recommend that you apply to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, which at that time was the number one acting school in England. Mm. I went to audition at the Old Vic Theatre School. I did two pieces. I was interviewed alone with just one other person in the room, who was the director of the school. And when I finished my second piece, he'd walked over to me and said, all right, Patrick, see you in September. And I said, and he said, yes, you've got a place in the school for the next 2 years. And I went home and told my parents, and they said, well, my father said, who's paying for it? I said, oh, Lord, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I went back and talked to her. I said, I got the job, I got a place, but I can't pay for it. And I thought I could save money, but I can't save enough.
Mm.
And she said, okay, you can apply for a grant from the local authority, the West Riding County Council. You should apply for it. So I did, and I was told, we can see you in 6 weeks or something like that, which was just long enough. And so I turned up, and there was there were 8 or 10 men, all in suits and shirts and ties, sitting behind a curving table, and me sitting on a little chair in front of them. And they all, one by one, began asking me questions. And some of them were quite scholarly and academic questions. But I think my previous headmaster had contacted them and said, look, he's not had a grammar school education, but he's very smart, very clever. And so they taught, and one chap said to me, so, right then, Patrick, if supposing we give you this scholarship, I mean, what good is that going to do us? Typical Yorkshire question. So I gave them a lot of bullshit about, oh, my objective will be to come back here and work here, and if I can do some teaching, I'll do that as well. And blah, 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 blah. And they said, all right, you'll hear from us in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Oh, Lord, I've got to wait. So I came home from selling furniture one day, and my mother was standing behind the door. We lived in a council house then, no longer the one up, one down. We'd lived in it for a year, and she said, this has come from here. It's got council building written on the front.
Mm.
Oh, Lord. Oh, I said, I think, yeah. And I opened it up, and I read the first sentence. Dear Mr. Stewart, we are so pleased to tell you that you've been granted an Oxbridge grant.
Yeah.
It had only been given, I discovered all this later, to Oxbridge students who'd been accepted into Cambridge or Oxford.
Yeah.
I had been nowhere near either of them. It was an incredible grant.
Yeah.
It paid for everything.
Paid for everything.
It included my lodging, pocket money, meals, food, tuition, everything.
Very important to see that government funding, if it's not there, we don't get Sir Patrick Stewart in the future. This is why it's very, very important to support the arts.
And why we're going through a very, very difficult time.
It's a bad time.
Because the arts are no... And this has been... Forgive me, I have been a lifelong socialist, member of the Labour Party. It is visible today very strongly. The opportunities have been reduced and reduced and reduced. I mean, theatres are closed. They're pulled down. Maybe they're, I don't know, lottery markets or casinos or something like that. But there are not the opportunities for even qualified actors that there used to be. And it's a very, very sad situation.
Well, we can only be grateful that a combination of support but also your hard work resulted in the amazing career that you had. We've only touched the surface of it in this conversation, but there's so much more in the book. I can only thank you once again, Patrick, for taking the time to write it.
I've enjoyed this immensely. Thank you.